9:09 as we make our way through this Thursday morning. We thought we'd take some time with the early voting underway and the presidential election looming to compare and contrast the health care plans of both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. So we invited our friend Walter Dublane, our go-to guy when it comes to health care. He's an associate professor of economics and finance at my alma mater, UNO, to help kind of walk us through it. How you doing, Dub?
Hey, good morning, Tommy. Good to be here.
I don't even know how you start to compare these two. I don't know if you look at different, look at different aspects of the healthcare program, and then what each is suggesting. What do you think would be the best way to go about this?
Well, I will tell you, it is difficult because neither one of them has a well spelled out plan. They've kind of made some suggestions about different approaches that they might have. So you can kind of talk about that, but that's kind of about all we can do.
Let me do this. Let me take a step back maybe for context and talk about where are we. Take us back to Obamacare, Affordable Health Care Act. What's changed since then? What hasn't? And if somebody doesn't have insurance right now through their company, what are their options?
Okay, well, Obamacare did a number of things, but the biggest one was it basically made sure that it made available insurance available to a large number of people. Of the 50 million that were uninsured in 2014 when this went into effect, you know, more than half of them got insurance through Obamacare two ways. One is the Medicaid rollout. Which, again, Louisiana did under Edwin Edwards. John Bell Edwards, excuse me. and then the other one is they have these individual plans, which are heavily subsidized. In the pandemic, that got kicked up a lot more so that you can really buy very affordable, some type of very affordable insurance. So that gave access to a lot more people having insurance. Did several other things. One of the other big ones is that insurance used to almost all be regulated by the state. That was federalized by Obamacare, by the Affordable Care Act, so that now they set the rules of anybody that wants to offer insurance as to what you have to offer. Includes all of these type of programs. So, those are the big things that that the ACA did.
So if somebody now, how has it changed since that went into effect? Have they changed it a lot or not?
Well, the only major change since then has been for Louisiana, because Louisiana didn't immediately, there's 12 other southern states that have not done the Medicaid rollout. And what that did was change the eligibility. Before John Bell Edwards accepted the new plan, which was paid for 90% by the federal government, to get on Medicaid in the United in Louisiana was almost impossible. Basically, it was only available to women with children or pregnant, that a kind of a single person almost never could qualify, and they had to be very poor. But then all of a sudden the eligibility changed to anybody up to 138% of the federal poverty line, which for family of four is like now 35,000 or so. So all of a sudden all those people got onto Medicaid. The only thing that's changed is that the single policies that you buy through healthcare.gov during the pandemic, they basically opened that up. Well, they'd opened the pandemic. They opened Medicaid up to almost anybody. Mm-hmm. And then they also opened up those policies to make them much more generous in terms of the subsidies that people got. Because usually to be on Medicaid, you have to check your actual income, right, to qualify. Well, they stopped doing that during the pandemic. And last year or so, they started doing that again, and a number of 100,000 people got kicked off that weren't eligible. This coming year, all of these big subsidies that went in the pandemic are due to expire. So the pandemic is the only other thing that's been a major change since 2014.
Okay, so there's still no upper limits. They still can't deny it for pre-existing conditions, and you can still keep
right.
Your
well, those,
kid.
Yeah, those are some other things that went in. The pre-existing condition exclusions were outlawed, and the upper limits were outlawed. That was part of the Affordable Care Act as well.
And that's still that way, right?
Correct. That's not going away.
That's not going away. And what about keeping your kid on your policy until they're 26?
Right. Yeah, that's, again, like I say, there were a lot of other, I mentioned kind of the biggest ones, but the pre-existing condition one was a huge one, because a lot of people who had pre-existing conditions basically couldn't buy insurance, and all of a sudden Obamacare opened that door to all of those people, and they rushed in and bought that with, of course, at very highly subsidized rates. That's been one of the huge ones.
So somebody texted in and wants to know about pre-existing conditions and buying insurance. If they don't have insurance and they know they need some type of operation, why would an insurance company take their premium to pay for the operation when after that they could drop the insurance? It just seems like one thing I never did understand about this, Dub, was from the insurance company standpoint, it's like, wait a minute, you can sign up for insurance, you're going to get your liver operated on or whatever you need, then you're going to drop it, so I'm on the hook for paying for your insurance. How do the insurance companies make this a sustainable business model for them?
Well, it really hasn't been very sustainable. This is a big problem. Now, originally, the way they were supposed to handle that was they had what's called the individual mandate, but that never worked. Mm-hmm. The idea was, well, the way we'll do it is we'll make sure people can't drop out because they have to have insurance. Well, the penalties they put on it were so small that when Trump did away with that provision, nobody noticed. So that one never worked.
Wait,
so, yes,
it
is a major
provision,
problem. The individual mandate.
The way you had to buy insurance.
Where that said that if you don't buy insurance, then you're going to have to pay a big tax penalty.
Right.
Well, the tax penalty was very small, and then it really never happened. Nobody really paid attention to it, and then Trump did away with that part of it. There is a corporate mandate that anybody with 50 employees or more must offer an affordable plan to all of their employees. That one has been enforced and has had a big effect.
So from the insurance company's standpoint, I'm still trying to figure this out. If I don't have insurance and I get diagnosed with some kind of liver, something or the other, pick an organ, I don't care, whatever it is, and I need to have it operated on and I don't have insurance through my company, I go to the healthcare.gov, I try to buy insurance, I can't be denied for a pre-existing condition, and I tell whomever it is that's providing this insurance, I want to sign up for a policy. Can they ask me why? Or you understand what I'm saying, Dave?
It's hard to believe, but that's the way the law was written.
So,
and we've had some cases of people actually signing up while in the hospital bed, you know, that type of thing. But
do the insurance companies, how do they make that work from the profit standpoint? Do they just make the premiums so high? Is there any limit on what they can charge
for
the premiums?
I mean, that is the other part of it is that the federal government's paying most of the premiums. So a lot of people are still getting it because for many people, the premiums are actually really pretty small if you're a fairly middle income person or less. I think a lot of people just signed up for it just to cover, you know, more normal type of stuff. But you're right, there's a huge loophole out there in terms of people can sign up whenever they want to.
Wow. So are there procedures that somebody else texted in? Are there procedures that the insurance companies can deny, or do the insurance companies and the healthcare.gov have to cover all procedures?
No, they can do. There's a prior authorization, it's called, that if the insurance company determines that the procedure is kind of new or experimental, something like that, or if they don't think it's necessary, that the patient doesn't have the, you know, they're worried that the doctor's doing unnecessary procedures, they can deny to pay for certain procedures. Yes, and they do.
So hypothetically speaking, somebody's unemployed, they need surgery, they go to healthcare.gov. They sign up, they get a policy. The government's going to pay for most of that. Just bear with me here and tell me if I'm saying anything wrong. then they get their surgery, and then they can choose not to have insurance after that?
They can, but of course, if they're really that unemployed, they wouldn't get on the healthcare.gov. They would get on Medicaid, because healthcare.gov does have, even though it has some premiums, it also has deductibles. If you're in the bronze plan, you might have $4,000 to $6,000 that you would have to pay before the insurance kicks in. But Medicaid has no premiums, and it has no copays and no deductibles. So that's the one that people want to get on if they qualify.
And what about procedures that Medicaid approves?
Well, again, now Medicaid is much more generous about approving things. It's because healthcare.gov is private insurance. You're getting a Blue Cross or a United plan, and those people have a policy of denying it. Medicare and Medicaid really don't do that nearly as much.
But Medicaid's a state program. Medicare is a federal program, right?
Correct. I mean, well, there, yes, the Medicaid is a state program. It's funded mostly by the federal government, but the state does have to kick in for the old people that were on Medicaid before the expansion. The state pays about a third of the cost in Louisiana, or 40%, and the federal government pays the rest. But people that signed up later under the new plan, which is like half of the Medicaid recipients, the federal government pays for 90%, and the state only pays 10%.
The state does run
the Medicaid program.
So somebody texted in about cancer treatment, and if they're on Medicaid, they would have to stay within the state?
Well, I think, again, the Medicaid is a state program. And so normally you would, I don't know for sure about this, so I think you might get exceptions if you had something you wanted to go over to MD Anderson or whatever. We now could go to MD Anderson in the state at Ochsner or, right, or St. Tammany or a place like that. But still,
How much choice do you have if you're on Medicaid of where you go to get your treatment?
You pretty much could go any place. I don't know. In terms of going out of the state, I'd have to double check on that. But you basically will go to anybody that will accept you, which, again, almost all community hospitals will accept the Medicaid patients. There's some of these, private doctor-owned surgery centers that don't accept Medicare and Medicaid patients. But if they have a surgery that's needed. Now, sometimes they have a problem getting a surgeon because the doctors, a lot of them do not. Most of them don't accept Medicaid patients, or at least very few. So sometimes they have a problem with that, but I think all hospitals do accept them.
So you get in the hospital, you just can't find anybody to operate on you.
Well, I mean, if you come in through the emergency room, then there'll be a doctor pretty much assigned to you, and you'll end up getting it done. But
if it's an emergency but not an elective procedure.
Right, right.
Yeah. It's complicated, man. I'm telling you. Let's take a break. We come back.
It's very, very complicated.
It is. That's why we lean on you heavily, Dublane, over at UNO.
Okay.
When we come back, somebody wants to know about the Medicaid expansion, how that's affected hospitals and doctors in Louisiana. We'll also talk about reproductive rights. We'll talk about prescription drug care and everything else. And then how much really control does whatever president have over any of this, or is it all about the Congress? It's complicated, and I hate personally dealing with anything as it relates to any type of insurance at all, as do, I'm sure, most of the people that are listening right now. Thankfully, Dublane studies it for a living. He's over at UNO, our go-to guy when it comes to matters about healthcare, associate professor of economics and finance at UNO. You have any questions, comments, 504-260-1870. Tommy Tucker, back in a flash on WWL. Talking to Dublane, our professor of economics and finance at UNO, my alma mater, about healthcare costs and affordable healthcare and the differences between what Trump and Harris are proposing. Before we get to any of that and Medicaid and everything else, so much of this has to do with the Congress, correct? Because I'm thinking of John McCain and his thumbs down vote.
Well, yes, that is the president. You know, we're looking at the presidential policies, mm-hmm. but anything, they have some control, but not much. Most anything would have to come through the Congress. And so the Senate, what's happening in the Senate and the House, is extremely important to whatever directions we end up making. So, if Trump went, of course, now Trump for 8 years said they wanted to repeal and replace Affordable Care Act. He's not even saying that anymore, mm-hmm. but he wants to do a certain other things. He wants to move it more in kind of a market direction, what's called consumer-directed health plans, which are kind of high-deductible health plans, together with health savings accounts. That seems to be an emphasis of his. Harris is really looking more towards expanding Obamacare to more people and, you know, controlling drug costs, things of that sort.
So how has the Medicaid expansion affected hospitals and doctors in Louisiana?
Well, it's been a trade-off, because before the Medicaid expansion, for instance, I'm also on the board of a local hospital. You know, we had about 8% of all of our patients were uninsured. Well, you know, uninsured patients cover about 10% of their costs, because some uninsured patients are actually fairly wealthy people that just don't have insurance, but most of them don't pay anything. And so all of a sudden, a big hunk of those got on Medicaid. And so our total uninsured went down to less than 2%. But then it replaced them with a bunch of Medicaid patients. The Medicaid patients only cover about 65% of the cost of actually caring for them. So they're heavily subsidized. And then the other trade-off was to pay for the Affordable Care Act. What they did was cut payments to hospitals from Medicare. So now they're getting less money on Medicare. So the whole... the whole package has been kind of a trade-off for hospitals.
So everybody wants to do something about prescription drug prices. How likely is that to happen, and how do you even go about that? Because it seems as though in maybe this drug or that drug, they have made a difference, but in a lot of others, they don't.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's this $35 for insulin thing that's both parties are, promoting. But then the other one is, you know, Biden has identified a dozen of these really high-cost drugs that they're trying to negotiate prices on, and they're wanting to add more every year. Harris has said she wants to continue that and expand that program. There's a lot of fight over that. Obviously, the pharmaceutical companies and a lot of other people don't like that. But I will tell you something that's really, you know, I don't think the average person knows, is that pharmaceuticals are far and away the fastest growing component of our healthcare system. 10, 15 years ago, they were only about 12% of all the costs that the insurance companies paid. Now they're over 22%. So there's been a huge increase in pharmaceutical costs in the last decade or so. So
is that,
is a concern.
The price of the pharmaceuticals, is it because of advertising and people wanting these medications? Is it because of the type of medication? And where, Dub, while I'm asking this big long question, where do pharmacy benefit managers fit in all of this? Because that's something that doesn't get a lot of attention, but it's an integral cog in this, right?
It is. And that, you talk about the confusing, that's the most confusing part. It has to do with some of these are these new drugs that Ozempic and all these other things like that they've come up with that have big ticket items. Some of them are really good. For some of the new cancer drugs are pretty effective, but you've got some that are costing $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year. You know, that's really a big deal. A lot of these other are very expensive, but some of the drug companies have really done some things like the little EpiPen. Well, those have been around forever, and somehow or another, the price of those went from $50 to $600. So they've been taking things that have been existed and just jacking up the price. And partly it's because the insurance companies, really, that's one area where they don't really have much ability to control what they do. For the doctors and hospitals, they kind of negotiate on prices. But for drugs, they're almost required to cover, certain drugs. And so it gets dumped on them. Furthermore, they can't even negotiate with the drug companies because they have to go through the pharmacy benefit managers. So these PBMs, they're called pharmacy benefit managers, are wholesalers that deal with all the actual, FISA and all these other big drug companies. And there's like 100 of them. You know, there's about 6 or 7 really big ones, but there's a whole bunch of little ones. And they buy the drugs at wholesale, and then they sell them to the drug stores.
All right, let me slow you down a little bit if I can.
Yes.
So let's talk about a pharmacy benefit manager. The day in the life of a pharmacy benefit manager, you said they have 6 big ones, 100 all overall about. What does a pharmacy benefit manager do?
Well, I say, there's about 6 big pharmacy producers.
Okay.
But the pharmacy benefit managers are the wholesalers.
Okay.
So they buy the drugs from the producers.
A middleman?
And then, what's that?
Like a middleman?
They are middlemen, exactly. Okay. And they're wholesalers. And then, for instance, your local Walgreens or other pharmacy or the hospitals, when they want to buy, you know, drugs for cancer, their cancer treatment or whatever it is, they buy their drugs through the PBMs. Blue Cross, I've got the chief economist of Blue Cross is a friend of mine, and he's got amazing information on this. But, you know, they basically, they can't do anything. The pharmacy benefit managers pretty much tell them, here's the prices, and they're stuck with it. They have really no negotiating power. So the PBMs basically control the prices almost completely for drugs. And nobody, you know, there's only three of them. And they're kind of behind the scenes. Nobody knows what they're doing. They are one of the biggest, big holes in the system that it's really hard to figure out what's going on.
Three pharmacy benefit managers?
Right. Three of them. So basically three wholesalers, like the drug companies that actually produce the drugs. There's 80% of the drugs come from about the big 10, but there's also dozens of these little ones that produce one little drug here or there, things of that sort. But they all go through the PBMs between the drug manufacturers and the hospitals, the insurance companies, and the pharmacies.
Why do the drug manufacturers want to go through the PBMs and not deal directly with the hospitals and what have you?
Well, that's a good question. I tell you from the insurance company's point of view, is that there's so many of them that they can't really, you know, even a company like Blue Cross can't negotiate with 100 different of these pharmacies. And so the wholesalers have developed. And now that they're into that, they can't get out of it. And I think the pharmaceutical manufacturers are benefiting from this because they can't concentrate on any one of them. But that's an area that I've been trying to study, and I find it enormously even hard to understand.
Would it be accurate to say these pharmacy benefit managers is like a big old black hole between the drug manufacturers?
Perfect description.
Money laundering, however you want to phrase it.
They do a lot of kind of really strange things because, of course, what the actual patient is concerned about is their out-of-pocket expense. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes that's a percentage or whatever. But then these PBMs play these games where they'll send a voucher to the patient that says, okay, well, I'm going to reduce your payment to only $5. Mm-hmm. Okay, so instead of being 20% of $100, being $20, they say, I'm going to only be $5, but they still charge the insurance company the full $100. Mm-hmm. And so, because the insurance companies can't negotiate with that. So they're getting people in to buy the drugs and they're getting the full price and the people say, oh, it's okay because I'm only paying $5. So they play all these kind of amazing games, and then they also, you know, you need to get some of the pharmacists to come in and talk about what their perspective is. But it is a big black hole.
So if the government were to really seriously want to do anything about prescription drug prices, they would have to have the desire to dig into what these pharmacy benefit managers are doing. Accurate or not?
They can do something directly. Like, for instance, that's what the Biden administration did do to say is to let Medicare, when they buy drugs, to negotiate with the pharmacies. Okay, and as far as I know, they're bypassing the PBMs on those drugs.
But just certain drugs,
now,
right?
Yes, but that's right now. It's only like a dozen drugs, right. Some of the big high cost ones. But they're supposedly going to be expanding that process over time. But other countries, have just set the prices for the drugs. Everybody else in the world sets the prices for the drug. We're the only ones where the drug companies through the PBMs can charge anything they want. There's a process called reference pricing that all the European and Canada uses, which is why they pay half or less for the drugs than what we pay.
Dub, we're going to have to leave it here for now while our eyes are glazed over, and I'm going to have to get a prescription to deal with whatever it is that I have now after talking about this with you.
I'm so sorry.
No. You did a great job. You did a great job. It's not you. It's just the situation, and it just seems like... you got this big black hole. Somebody's making a lot of money, and whenever there's money, yes, there's power and influence, and that's what we're talking about. Yes.
Well, and the pharmaceutical companies are making a lot of money.
Yep. Thank you, Dub.
Okay.
Appreciate it as always. Have a good day out at UNO. Walter Dub Lane, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at UNO. We're going to take a break, come back, talk with Holly Cosell. Speaking of healthcare, credentialed NBA writer covering the Pelicans. They opened with a win last night against the Chicago Bulls. But there were some health implications. We'll talk about that when we return. 940, 20 till 10, traffic now, WWL. There we go. 9:46 now, 14 till 9. The Pelicans beat the Bulls last night, but at what cost? Holly Cosell joins now, credentialed NBA writer covering the Pelicans. How you doing, Holly?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm doing well. And yeah, you're absolutely right. At what cost? Because it was a mixed bag. You get a win, but you lose an important player.
Tell me your thoughts on the, first of all, Zion. What do you know about him?
Well, Zion picked up an illness several days ago. And it didn't look like he was going to play yesterday. Sure enough, he did not. But from what I'm hearing, he's going to be able to make that trip. Pelicans are going off on a four-game road trip starting tomorrow in Portland, and that he should probably be available. So that's the good positive there.
Tell me about DeJon Murray. What do we know about him?
Yeah, unfortunately, he was on his way.
Murray. What did I say? DeJounte Murray.
Yeah, DeJounte. Trust me, we've all done it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was on his way to a nice game, triple-double. Wasn't shooting the ball well, but you could tell the offense was flowing much better with him at the controls. And defensively, I thought he did a decent job of slowing down Zach LaVine, who was incredibly hot for the Bulls in the first half. And it looked like he went up on a jump shot late, landed wrong, where he was trying to brace himself with his left hand and apparently fractured his left hand. Looks like he's probably going to be out for 3 to 6 weeks. Of course, we won't know for certain until we know what kind of fracture it was.
Hang on one second while I beat my head against the microphone. Ollie, hang on while I beat my head against the microphone. Can you please?
Okay. Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah.
I mean, look, would it be a Pelican season if we weren't talking about injuries in the first week, right? I mean, I had all the Saints fans trying to console me with that.
But it's just, man, you know, man.
Yeah, it's awful news because DeJounte has been actually a model, durable type of player, especially while he was in Atlanta. So for him just to go out like that in the first game when you're already missing Trey Murphy, now the Pelicans will be out, what, with two of their best six players, Tommy? Yeah, it's just not conducive to getting to a great start.
Thoughts about the rest of the help from the Pelicans bench, et cetera?
I'm sorry, say that again, Tommy.
Thoughts about the help from the Pelicans bench, et cetera, and the whole
small ball
concept?
The bench was incredible. Yeah, look, last year that was one of their biggest strengths, but after losing Dyson Daniels and Larry Nance this past offseason and several other guys, you were worried that maybe this team wouldn't have that kind of support from the reserves. But no, Eve Missy, I mean, let's start there. Pelicans rookie draft pick, 21st from the last draft. Nobody expected for him to be able to contribute right away because he's a raw basketball player. You saw that with his lone year in Baylor, and he's a guy that just started playing basketball, Tommy, at age 15. He's now 20. But you wouldn't believe that he played 23 minutes, only picked up 2 fouls, and I thought he was crucial in changing the momentum of the game, where the Bulls, not only were they hitting threes, they were getting a lot of layups. So he came in, started erasing some shots, and before you know it, the Pelicans were the ones now creating the turnovers and running up the score on their opponent by getting to the rim. So Eve Missy, stellar debut. And then, of course, you had Jordan Hawkins, who was probably the Pelicans' best player in preseason. He got off to a quick start, hit a couple of shots. And you got to give credit to a guy like Devontae Green. I think we've even talked about him on your show before. Mm-hmm. Somebody was going to have to fill that role of Najee Marshall, Dyson Daniels, one of the wings that's going to be Willie's best defender off the bench. And it looks like with his 4 steals, Javonte Green's well on his way to doing that.
So looking ahead, how do you see this playing out with the injury to DeJounte Murray and, I guess, Zion will be back? I don't exactly know what's wrong with him, but.
Yeah, Zion just had a viral infection, okay, right? So he was always going to miss probably just one game. So he's going to jump right into the lineup. And essentially, Tommy, what we're going to have is what we saw last year, right? CJ's going to roll over to a point guard position, but he's not going to be the de facto point guard. most of the ball initiation, right, for the offense will come from Brandon Ingram and Zion Williamson. And you simply have Daniel Tice replacing Jonas Valanciunas from last season. So it's kind of almost, I don't know if it's funny to say, but, yeah, the Pelicans are going to be doing what they tried to get away from this offseason, right? Because they wanted to go small, get away from playing a traditional big and not having a legitimate point guard on the floor. Well, they're going to be back to that, it looks like, for probably at least several weeks. Like I said, I think 3 to 6 weeks is what I'm guessing Murray's going to be out.
Next up, they play Portland. How do they match up against the Trail Blazers?
Well, you got to like the matchup. It's another young team, inexperienced, not expected to do well this year. So if the Pelicans, who have, you know, multitude of weapons, right? So we're talking about two guys that are out, but if they get Zion back, they'll still have four legitimate 20-point scorers. So they'll have enough offense. And you saw the defense yesterday. Still looked a lot like the defense we saw the last couple of seasons. So you expect them to do well, right? Portland last in the Western Conference standings last season. They aren't expected to improve much. So I expect them to honestly fetch two wins if they play decently.
And you said with DeJounte Murray, 4 to 6 weeks, is that what you said?
Yeah, the usual expectation is when you fracture a left hand, and this is not with surgery, right? If surgery is required, it may take a little bit more. But the standard time is usually 3 to 6 weeks.
All right. Thank you, Ali. It's just frustrating.
I mean, I went through a little more joyful, right? They got off to a nice start yesterday.
No, I know. I understand. I get all of that, but we're all excited about DeJounte Murray and – and, man, yeah, we talked about beforehand about Zion, and I understand he's coming back. It was just a viral thing, but it was just kind of a deflating thing almost. You know what I'm saying? I know they won, and we should all be happy that they won and that they'll probably beat Portland, but it's just, you know what I'm saying.
It's never a perfect situation. I looked around the league. There was at least three or four other injuries, right? So it's not just the Pelicans, but, yeah, it feels like it. I know.
You know what? That's right. It's never a perfect situation. Words to close on. Thank you, Ollie.
We'll talk to you again soon. Have a good weekend.
You too, man. Ollie Cosell, credentialed NBA writer covering the Pelicans. Newell is taking his show on the road. We'll talk about it when we come back here on WWL.